Welcome to Broad Appeal, the podcast that looks back at female-driven films from the not-so-distant past. I'm Sean.
And I'm Brian.
How are you, Brian?
Well, you know, Sean, I'm trembling with the anticipation of a change.
Oh yeah? I'm super as always. So today's film is Carrie from 1976 by Brian De Palma, starring Sissy Spacek, Piper Laurie,
Amy Irving
and Nancy Allen.
And John Travolta.
Yes, I hear him. It does not star Karen Black or Karen Allen, who I usually get confused with in general. This is a first. It is quite truly, possibly, accurately, the first horror film that we're doing on this podcast.
Now, why is that, Sean?
Because you don't like horror films, Brian.
Hold on. I don't want to take that lying down. Since knowing you, I have seen more horror films than I've ever seen in my life. So basically, four.
Yes, and the amount of films that you and I watch together, four horror films, is a disgrace.
But what I'm saying is that before knowing you, I don't think I've watched any horror films. So that's a 400% increase.
Mm.
You know, I think I have impeccable taste in the horror films that I decide to see. The Babadook, It Follows, Get Out. They're not just horror films. They tap into important issues of, you know, racism, sexism, urban decay, sexuality. I mean, these are horror films that aren't just exploitation. They're art, all
great.
Right?
Okay, I also like monsters, all right? Monsters and psychopaths. But we'll talk more about our relationship later. It's a first for me because Carrie, which is today's film, was one of the first adult books that I ever bought and read.
Can I say something, though? You say this about every book that we do. You said this about Rebecca. You said this about The Handmaid's Tale. Literally every book that we do, you say it was one of the first adult books.
Yeah,
that
one
you
of the first.
So basically, we...
whatever.
So is Carrie the first Stephen King novel you read?
Yes.
It's also the first Stephen King novel that was ever published. Not the first that he wrote, I discovered.
He wrote short stories,
but he'd written other novels that weren't getting any traction. And he actually, this is according to Wikipedia, he wrote this opening scene with the menstruation, the girls in the shower throwing the stuff at her. And he just thought like, oh, no one's going to like this. And he crumpled it up. He threw it in the wastebasket. And his wife, Tabitha, pulled it out and was like, no, you should write this. And you should write it particularly because it's from a female perspective. So isn't that interesting?
That's also in the introduction to the edition of Carrie that we read, which I can tell you didn't read.
If we're going to get guilt-tripping, I actually read the book in preparation for this podcast, which you did not.
Yeah, I was too busy, but I also read it 13 years ago. So when you're a young person, I think it's important that writing takes you away from kind of Famous Five adventures to something grotesque and grisly and very grown up. Things that you would not necessarily be allowed to watch on television, but you can read in a book.
So your mother had no problem with you reading Stephen King?
Books were never censored in my home.
Interesting. Apparently, Carrie is one of the most censored books in America.
What?
Still to this day. Yeah. Lots of school libraries ban it. This, again, is according to Wikipedia. It was a very informative article. No, but like lots, I mean, your mother may be particularly lenient, but I think a lot of people would find, the parents would think, oh my God, my kids are reading this book, which is about like all sorts of troubling sexuality and bullying and like supernatural powers and vengeance wreaked. I mean, I can understand why a parent wouldn't want their kid reading that.
I can understand it, but...
And why a school librarian might decide it was not appropriate.
Let children read whatever they want.
Well, is this a novel for children?
Absolutely not.
Well, what are you saying?
Is a teenager a child?
Well, no, but I mean, what is it about the horror genre that you think young people get? Is it tapping into some kind of primal something?
Young people, children, love to be scared. It's not universal, Brian. I'm sure you didn't like to be scared when you were a child.
Says who?
It's called an educated guess.
People enjoy encountering nightmarish situations kind of refigured into fiction. Horror narratives, and whether it's Dracula or whether it's this or, you know, whatever it might be, I guess they're tapping into those same kind of primal fears. You know, Freud would probably have something to say about it.
But if you also think about children in general are experiencing the world from the eyes of a complete unknown. They're growing up. There's a world outside the street you live on. That wickedness and goodness comes in different forms, and that the changes that happen to yourself will be both mysterious and enthralling and intoxicating and terrifying.
Yeah, and I guess, like, Carrie itself, it's a story of a young woman, adolescent herself, who so much has been forbidden of her by her mother, and so much she's told is dirty and something she should avoid. The story is so much about repression and about cutting a child off from maybe some of her natural development that it sort of bursts out in this really destructive way. It is very much about transitioning from childhood into adulthood, because the first scene is obviously about her becoming a woman through her long-delayed menstruation finally arriving.
Yeah.
Can I say something about my youthful experience of Stephen King?
Yeah, please.
Which is only secondhand. In high school, I would not have gone near a Stephen King novel with a 10-foot pole. I literally would tell you, at Pierce Middle School in Milton, Massachusetts, we often had book reports, and I can remember we had one cool English teacher, Mr. Tart, the cool teacher who'd, like, come to Massachusetts from California, and he was just like, you know, guys, like, whatever, you guys should be able to pick whatever books you want to read. So of course, literally like half the kids wanted to do Stephen King books. So I got like listen to book reports about Cujo, like all this stuff. And I remember I picked 1984 by George Orwell.
Okay, good choice.
Yeah, a good choice. Yeah. And also,
kinda
frankly,
cool.
The first book I ever read that had a sex scene in it.
Oh, wow.
It was like highbrow enough and I knew it was serious political enough. But the girl who read Carrie, I remember her so vividly. She was one of the most outcast girls in our class. She was super brilliant, but she was very strange. And she was like the Carrie White of our middle school class.
Physically, what was she like?
She was very tall and gangly and wore sort of dirty clothing a lot of the time. And people just were like, what's the deal with this girl? And I remember feeling so uncomfortable listening to her describe the plot of this story, which I'd never heard of. Because she had to talk about like menstruation and stuff in front of everyone. And we'd had sex ed in elementary school, but it had been the boys had theirs separately and the girls had theirs separately.
Wait, terrible.
But then in middle school, they brought us together. So suddenly the boys were all being educated about menstruation. And like, I literally got ill.
Are you serious?
I had to leave the room. That's what happens when you're raised by nuns, folks.
Oh my God.
So in a sense, what's interesting to me is that here was this girl talking about this novel that in a lot of ways, probably I could relate to, right? I mean, I'm not saying I was like told that my body parts were dirty pillows. In a sense though, I guess I was a bit like a male Carrie White. I wasn't as ostracized as she is, but just in the sense of like stunted development. And yet hearing this thing about like Stephen King and these novels and their horror and their whatever, I was like, oh my God, I would never, never, never want to read that. And I ran off and read
The Bostonians.
E.M. Forster. Yeah. It was really fascinating to read the book now. I mean, I appreciate the strength and the power and the muscularity of Stephen King's writing. It's very different, though, structurally than I expected. From your reading 13 years ago, do you remember, like, how the novel is constructed?
Well, I had seen half the film before I read the novel. I caught the end of the film one night on TV. My mother let me watch it.
No. So you knew the ending?
Oh yeah, everyone knew the ending. The DVD cover, it has a burning building behind her and her covered in blood. So when I read the book and found out that it was divided into these kind of like witness statements, newspaper cuttings, pieces of fiction, I enjoyed it because it makes it pulpy and digestible. But at the same time, it is a work of literary fiction.
I actually dispute that it makes it digestible, because what it does is it constantly fractures your understanding of the story. Basically, you have a sort of straight narrative, uh-huh. right? Often very close to Carrie's consciousness or the other characters' consciousnesses. But then you have, like, extracts from newspaper articles or scholarly books that are written after the events in Chamberlain, Maine, or the White Report, which is like, you know, the...
Not the Hyde Report, but the White Report.
Not the Warren Commission, the congressional inquiry into telekinesis. Just as you're getting into one aspect of the story that seems to like be telling you what happened, it like switches to a different perspective. From early on, we, the reader, are told that something terrible happened on prom night. And we know that Carrie White has these strange powers, but King keeps preventing you from understanding the full extent of what it was. You know, it's like, it's a very simple plot. Like, it all takes place over just, like, a week.
Yeah, that's why explaining it is so simple. And for those at home who have been living under a rock, Carrie White is an ostracized girl at school who lives in a very oppressive household with her religious nut mother.
Mm-hmm.
After getting her period in the shower room at school...
Very late, it should be said.
Very late.
Right?
16,
she's like a high school senior. Yeah.
She gets completely humiliated by the other girls. As a result, they all can't go to prom because they're punished for doing it. Sue Snell, who's played by Amy Irving, convinces her boyfriend to invite Carrie as a way to appease things and make everything right in the world. But then the bitchy one, Chris Hargison, plots with her friends to humiliate Carrie at the prom by dumping blood on her head. And then
The
blood of a pig. And then Carrie demonstrates her telekinetic powers and kills everybody.
My memory is, in the film, that Carrie's telekinesis is only hinted at all through the main part of the film until it, like, comes out full force at the end.
Well, does that bit, the ashtray in the principal's office, remember he keeps calling her Cassie, and, like, she goes, it's Carrie! And, like, the ashtray flips
over.
Yeah,
I mean, there's other things that happen, but in the book, there's extensive discussion of all these sorts of things that she's done, like raining stones on her mother's house, when she's mad at her mother when she's much younger, and she's, like, training her mind to, like, move the furniture and stuff like that. It's not really a novel of suspense because you kind of know this girl has this uncontrollable supernatural power. And you know that something terrible happens. So literally all you're waiting for is kind of the exact gory details of just how horrible it is. And then the whole final section after the prom is just chapters and chapters of, like, how everyone except Sue Snell, like, perishes.
Doesn't the town get destroyed in the book?
The entire town, like, goes into, like, a fucking inferno, and almost everyone is decimated.
Now, how does Sue Snell get out of it again?
Because she's not at the prom, because she...
She's out of town.
No, because she sends her boyfriend as Carrie's date, and she can't go herself, so she's at home. I guess one of the things that I'm really wondering your take on is, like, is this a feminist story? Apparently Stephen King thinks this is about a woman coming into her power. He apparently really thinks this is about the women's movement. Now, yes, in a way, Carrie White is... I mean, she's a little bit like our dear friend Erica Kohut from the Piano Teacher, where she has been so raised in such a perverse way by this oppressive mother that she's reacting antisocially and, like, strangely in response to that bizarre raising. Do you remember why the mother has become a kind of religious zealot?
Isn't it because she... Isn't Carrie, like... Oh, no, just tell me.
The mother has had extramarital sex when she's young, and that results in a miscarriage. So she then thinks she's been punished by God, and sex is terrible and bad. So she ends up being with Carrie's father, and they vow not to have sex, even though they're married. And then...
They give in one night,
and Carrie's father, like, sort of takes her because he can't control his lust anymore, and Carrie is the result of that. So the mother just hates Carrie.
She's original sin.
Yeah, she, like, represents Eve and original sin, and she wants Carrie to stay a girl and not get breasts and not have menstruation. And also, she views Carrie as a witch because Carrie has this telekinetic gene that has become activated. And in a way, like, the mother is right.
I think part of Stephen King's talent as a writer is that he somehow kind of needles his way into the murkiest aspects of humanity and society. I do not think that Carrie is an anti-feminist book. I don't think it's a feminist book. It shows what happens when the worst aspects of what someone believes in, or the worst aspects of what society can give you, mutate and metastasize until they take over and destroy people's lives.
Isn't the mother, just the way she's depicted, like, is she a human being at all, or is she just, like, an evil, crazy-ass zealot?
Well, you know, a lot of people who are deeply religious think they are forces of good when actually they're forces of pure
wickedness. Like, I'm just saying, like, the mother, the depiction of Mama in this book...
No, she's a beast.
There is absolutely no... It makes, like, Mama Kohut in The Piano Teacher seem like, you know, Glinda the Good Witch.
Yeah.
She's just so unrelentingly horrible to Carrie. And all the girls in the school are so unrelentingly horrible. Through most of it, you're like, oh, this poor, vulnerable girl. She's so mistreated by everyone. And then when she is given attention from the jockey boy who takes her to the prom, she just feels so happy. You're like, oh my God, I feel for this girl. It's like a Cinderella story. And then she destroys everyone. That is the genius of this book, and also this book's provocation, that it gets you to relate to this young woman's vulnerability and pain and ostracization, and then she turns, like, completely and becomes a mass murderer.
But are you not rooting for Carrie in this moment? When she's wreaking havoc upon the town, are you not like, go, girl, go?
But you are and you aren't, because it's indiscriminate. I mean, it's not just against the people who have wronged her. I mean, I guess, like, the thing is, Carrie is so uninformed about why this has happened, right? She doesn't understand that it's a few people who've conspired to humiliate her, right? The entire faculty of the school, innocent bystanders, neighbors, like local businesses, they're all destroyed in a giant inferno. You know, a presidential commission is called to say, like, how can we prevent this Holocaust from happening again? And like, the power that is unleashed, this irrational power, is chilling. Like, I could imagine if I was reading this not knowing what was coming, it would be like,
I'm trying to think of when I was reading these books for the first time. I remember The Shining very particularly. I had to put it down every so often. There's an episode of Friends where Joey has to put The Shining in the freezer because he's too scared of it. I don't really remember reading Carrie with the same terror that I read other things. Mostly because I liked Carrie and I wanted her to destroy people. Well, but I think now I'd view it in a, you know, much more complex way, as you said. It becomes indiscriminate.
Well, you know, of course, as we're recording this, one of the most successful movies that's out right now is Get Out. You and I both heard Jordan Peele interviewed, and I think one of the things that he's pointed out, I think really, you know, insightfully, is that horror films work when they take a fear that lots of us have and sort of amp it up or use it as the basis for the terror.
Yeah.
So, like Rosemary's Baby, anyone who's expecting a child has a lot of anxiety around,
you know, how's it going to turn out?
Yeah, how will it
be healthy? Will you like it? Yeah.
And similarly, like something like It Follows is playing on the idea of teenage sexuality and like sexually transmitted diseases, that these kids have sex with one another and then they're like attacked by ghosts.
But even things like A Nightmare on Elm Street, you know, you go to sleep when a situation where you have no control over what's going to happen and you can possibly die.
Right, exactly. And Get Out is based around like the social horror. The tension of it is putting us in the perspective of this black character who is the only black person in this white society where he feels like he'd be under threat. Even if it was just a standard drama with no supernatural elements, he would feel, I'm possibly at risk of violence or all sorts of things.
Well, this is why I'm very excited about It coming out as well.
Why? Because what? That's the fear of clowns.
Well, it's partly that, of course. Clowns, for me, have always been terrifying, long before I ever heard of what coulrophobia was.
What a phobia?
Coulrophobia.
Cooler?
Coulrophobia.
That's the fear of clowns.
Yeah. Maybe it's coulrophobia.
Wow, I've C-O-U-L- never heard of that.
Oh, yeah.
How do you spell it?
C-O-U-L, like, R-O, phobia.
Wow, ladies and gentlemen, vocabulary word of the day. Yeah. Thank you, Mr. McGovern.
Well, check Google for the true spelling of it. But the point of it is, you know what it is about?
An evil clown.
No, it's not about an evil clown. It's about this town where this unspeakable evil that's exists for centuries wakes up and it preys on the things that the children are most afraid of. And it manifests itself in the form of a clown. This is why some of the best horror films have children in them. Because children are never listened to by the adults, first of all.
Right.
And the world itself is a terrifying place, both if there's an evil at large, but also because they're children.
What are the deep-seated social anxieties that Carrie is playing on? It's something to do with being laughed at and humiliated and rejected when you're a teenager.
Yeah. It also plays on the consequence of not allowing a child to blossom.
Because Carrie essentially has been told by her mother, like, stay away from boys, they're only trouble. The mother is wrong, but she's also right.
And it's also about the consequences of being horrible to someone.
Right.
The person who you teased or laughed at, you know, one day they're going to flip out and punch you. Not to relate this to my own experience, but you were talking about, you know, the girl in your class. Well, I grew up in an area where there were lots of parents who were very, very tightly wound. They wound their children up as a result. And there are people that I knew.
You, based around what? Around, like, religion or traditions? Or
a little bit of both. It was nowhere near Margaret White territory. But I remember being a kid and like being like, this is weird. Things that the children could only wear all the time, or things that they weren't allowed to say at the dinner table. I felt that we were not on the same cultural wavelength when I would go and visit them. And as a consequence, a couple of families that had what I would call very tightly wound children ended up having a lot of teenage pregnancies in their family.
Wow. So I guess it's like the fear is sort of teenage rebellion generally, because actually Carrie is sort of mirrored in the story by Chris Hardison, right? Who is like, would have been the prom queen, is the beautiful one. But actually her sexuality is very dangerous as well. Like she sleeps with her boyfriend. He's the one who helps her with the pig's blood. And in a way, like her force for mischief and menace is actually what sets Carrie off. So they're the kind of yin and yang balancing poles there, you know, and poor little Sue Snell is caught in the middle. We're really going deep in kind of the resonance and the relevance of the story. Brian De Palma's adaptation of this film is very highly regarded, viewed as...
That opening scene in the shower.
I thought the book would have some sort of, like, preamble, but no, it's just, like, here we are in the shower. Because I literally thought, like, oh, that's creepy, like, straight man Brian De Palma, like, perving on some girls in the shower. But no, that's the way the book begins, too. But what I'm saying is, like, the 1976 film is very highly regarded, but there is just something about this story that has kept drawing people to it, because it is not just this one film. Like, in our Yentl episode, you mentioned that Amy Irving returns in...
The Rage Carrie 2. The premise of it is that Carrie has a half-sister. Obviously, Carrie's mother dies. It's the father, Ralph. So he is the father of this other daughter whose mother...
Who also has the telekinetic gene.
So it's passed on by him.
And Sue Snell has survived to become middle-aged Amy Irving.
Yeah, who I think might be like a high school counselor
and
or something.
Just, oh my God, she runs into the same situation and it all happens again.
But you know what the girl's presented like in this one? She's kind of like punky, outcast, indie.
Because it's like late 90s, isn't it?
Yeah.
So there's that.
There's also a two-part TV thing of
Carrie.
Yeah.
Was that any good?
It was very faithful to the book. But
if it was faithful to the book, why did it take two parts? Because the book's very short. Okay, so we don't know much about that. But what about the recent film version?
Well, I find the idea of Chloe Grace Moretz as Carrie to just be an impossible thing to get my head around.
Because why?
Because she's far too spunky and good looking.
She's very conventionally pretty.
Because to me, Sissy Spacek always has this ethereal implacability, this kind of weirdness to her that I don't really know who or what she is. And she's definitely not your traditional leading lady.
So you're talking about she is perfect as Carrie.
Yeah.
Actually, in the book, Carrie's a bit more...
Chunky
and chubby, and kind of, I think, the pig thing is, playing into that. Because you didn't go see the recent...
I had no
remake.
Interest in it.
Was it mostly because just the casting of Chloe Grace Moretz seemed like it was totally off?
It's directed by Kimberly Pierce, so I was intrigued by that. You know, who did Boys Don't Cry?
Yeah.
So, like, there's all these things.
And, of course, it has one of America's greatest living actresses
as
the
mother. Yes, Julianne Moore, I'm nothing against remakes. Remakes have been happening since the studio system, but why bother with this and that casting?
Because we love Julianne Moore when she's off her rocker. Like, you fucking loved Maps to the Stars.
I fucking loved it, yeah.
So don't you think, like, the idea of Julianne Moore, like, screaming about dirty pillows and, like, Jesus and shit, would at least make those scenes worth the price
of
admission?
Well, it's on Netflix.
Now, are we gonna go far enough as to listen to some of the songs from Carrie the Musical?
I might actually listen to some. I'm sure it's on Spotify.
Do you know the story of Carrie the Musical?
It was a huge failure.
Do you know where it started?
Broadway.
No, Sean.
Where?
You are the one who informed me that the Rocky Horror Show began at the Royal Court. Do you know where Carrie the Musical began?
Oh my God, not the National Theatre.
The Royal Shakespeare Company.
What?
The Royal Shakespeare Company produced the first production of Carrie the Musical.
I've just farted with sheer horror.
Talk about Coriolanus. But... not only that, it was choreographed by Debbie Allen.
Are you kidding me?
I am not kidding you. I just found all this out. It featured acclaimed Broadway performer Barbara Cook in the original
RSC. I've heard of her.
Well, I certainly hope you have. There are a few podcast listeners who just collapsed the fact that you didn't instantaneously know who she was. She's a Kennedy Center winner.
Other things.
Anyway, I mean, it was like made with some real talent behind it, and then went to Broadway and was one of the most expensive, quickly dying flops in Broadway history. I actually don't think people think it was that bad, but it was just like didn't go down well.
How did they kill everyone every night? Like, how much blood for these lighting? I have no idea.
It was, for a while, it was kind of a cult hit and kind of re-revived, I think.
Well, it was revived
recently,
Broadway, wasn't it? No, in London. Like, wasn't it the Menier Chocolate Factory or...
Oh, maybe.
Something, because I remember seeing The Signs of Seven Sisters.
Would you think it would work as a musical? I guess it kind of would, because musicals are all about those, like, inner longings, the desires that are so strong that they can only come out in song.
I find the idea of a musical that's building up to one thing the entire time just to be, I don't know,
But don't most musicals build up to, like, the big dance?
Well, what I mean is musicals give you the payoff every few minutes.
Maybe it should be a grand opera instead. I can Madame Butterfly.
I can get with that much easier.
Yeah?
Have you ever thought that maybe Death Becomes Her could be a musical?
It practically is. Sorry to be heretical here, folks. Death Becomes Her does not have a good enough story to be anything other than the mediocre film that it is.
Get out.
I'm sorry, that is a mediocre
Get
film.
Out.
It's half of a good film.
I love that film.
Half of a good film.
And I won't hear anything said against it.
Again, hate mail. I'm sure it's coming from acclaimed best-selling author Michael Shulman, but I don't care. You're actually psyching up my hormones.
How long has this been?
It's been long. You're psyching up my hormones. You know, my estrogen levels are rising and I'm ready to watch Carrie, but I want to just quickly run down the actressing in this film, right? I think the weird thing about this is, like, Sissy Spacek, it's really weird that she became known for this horror movie. She's not a, like, B-movie actress. Like, certainly nowadays, she is a very prim, kind of straight-laced kind of actress. I mean, I guess Carrie smashes things, and so does her character in the bedroom when she smashes that plate and says, "You let him get away with everything!"
You know, she was in The Ring 2, which is a horror film.
If she was in this movie now, she'd be the mother, and she'd be absolutely appropriate as that kind of, like, tight-knit. What I'm saying about Sissy Spacek's persona is that she really has kind of two phases of her career, like wispy girl and then, like, prim schoolmarm.
I wouldn't mind having a look at Sissy Spacek's filmography after we press.
I love Sissy Spacek. She's great in Coal Miner's Daughter as well. Yeah. Do you have any other opinions on the other performers in this? Piper Laurie also got an Oscar nomination
for
The
Mother. Yeah, she did. Did she get Best as well?
Best Supporting Actress.
Oh, so she's supporting.
Yeah.
Okay, yeah.
How about Amy Irving? We have a newfound appreciation for Hadass from Yentl and Sue Snell. I mean, these are some of the great female characters in the pantheon.
Oh, I love her. No, I don't really think about her.
She's also the singing voice of Jessica Rabbit, so she's given us hours of pleasure in some of our favorite movies.
Let's not
movies.
Forget, very rich because of Steven Spielberg.
I'm sure those alimony payments help a lot. And Nancy Allen. Nancy Allen is a confusing one. We both realize that we're not quite sure if Nancy Allen is Karen Black.
Or Karen Allen.
Who's Karen Allen again?
I don't know. Isn't she someone?
I think probably. Yeah, the 70s, those women were all kind of like, some of them were in Robert Altman movies, some of them were in Brian De Palma movies, some of them were probably in both Robert Altman and Brian De Palma. I don't know.
Well, I just realized that she's in RoboCop, which I love. She has short hair in RoboCop, so you can tell how I made a mistake.
Well, she was married to Brian De Palma, apparently, after making Carrie.
Was she in The Black Dahlia?
No, but she's in a couple other Brian De Palma movies. Okay, I feel like it's almost time to wrap this up and get to the thing.
I don't know about you, but I've been really intensely spaced out during this first half. I don't know, it feels like there's a weird tunnel between the two of us.
Sean, why is that microphone levitating?
Don't make any jokes.
Do you think this movie's going to be scary again? I mean, we've both seen it before, we both know what's happening.
I think the horrors of high school will be by far the scariest thing about it.
It might be the menstruation for me.
I've got absolutely no issue with menstruation, you know.
I hate to say it, it's just like, I'm a gay man, like, things like that. I know you're a gay man as well, but you're far more evolved than I am.
But Brian, gay sex involves bodily fluids.
Yeah, but not...
What's wrong? It's just, like, menstruation is just a reddish-brownish, iron-rich, spongy lining that comes out of every woman once a month.
Will you hold my hand, Sean, as we go through this?
Okay, fine. Here we go, Brian.
We'll just take a bit of a menopause and return after we've re-encountered Carrie White.
Get out of here. Go on, right now. Move. Carrie? Carrie, I'm sorry. I'm sorry. I didn't know.
Sean, the first sin was intercourse. Say it.
The first sin was intercourse.
The first sin was intercourse, Sean.
The first sin was intercourse.
The first sin was intercourse. And the last movie that we saw was Carrie.
How'd you feel?
It was pretty much exactly as I recalled. A strange combination of teen flick and supernatural revenge thriller. Just as I remembered, it really doesn't feel to me like a horror movie.
How it felt to me was a deeply tragic, sad film. Not unlike The Fly, which is one of my favorite films. The Fly is an example of a sci-fi horror film that at the end of it, you just feel sad for everybody. And this is, you know, in the same vein.
I'm just going to say, at the end of The Fly, I did not feel sad for Stathis, okay? Stathis, the villain. And I also don't feel sad in this for Chris Hardison and John Travolta, whatever his name was. There are people you don't feel sad for. And I don't feel sad for Carrie's mother in this either. But I agree with you. There is a tone of melancholy and, like, lost possibility. The film, for most of its length, is actually just like a sort of teen drama. I think maybe if you forgot it was a horror film, you'd be like, oh, look at this girl blossoming. And that's Brian De Palma's sneaky genius.
Well, I'm just so glad that quite a long time has passed between me seeing it that time and this time. The first time I was watching it, I was like, oh, wow, I can't wait for this massacre to happen. As an adult, I don't know, you suddenly become a little bit more... Like, you know, you start crying at the news when you get older. Am I right? But the way I felt watching this was...
Babe, everyone's crying at the news these days, okay?
I was thinking, oh God, this horrible thing's going to happen at the end of the film. And so when we would divert away from that, like there's a whole scene in which the boys go shopping for tuxes and it lulls you into this sense of security that this is a teen movie. And you were asking the question to me while we were watching it, when did the teen movie schematic get formulated? How long was John Hughes after this?
Yeah, I guess you had teen movies that were like the beach blanket movies in the sense of like Gidget and, you know, that kind of thing. But the idea of a movie that's set in high school with like the mean girls and the nerdy girl and the girl dating the jock and all that, like it does feel like Carrie is referencing that genre, but I don't think there are that many of those stories that predate Carrie. It's a really interesting thing that De Palma and the creative team have somehow tapped into that as a thing that doesn't yet exist. But they're playing all those notes, and you kind of want it to be like She's All That with Rachel Lee Cook, like, taking off her glasses and the ugly duckling becomes a swan, and you absolutely totally forget that it's also the story of a telekinetic freak, like, destroying an entire community.
Honey?
Yeah?
Why?
Why what?
Why am I here?
Because it's the prom.
Why am I here with you?
Because I asked you.
Why'd you ask me?
Because I wanted to.
Why'd you want to?
Because you liked my poem. Only I didn't write it, somebody else did. Carrie, we're here. And we're together. And I like it. I do, I like it.
Somewhere during the viewing of this one, I said to you, wouldn't it be nice if this was just a film where Carrie has a great prom and all these terrible things don't happen?
Sure, you didn't say it in that humorous way. You said it in like, oh God, I really wish these bad things weren't going to happen to Carrie. It was literally like you were getting really hormonal. Do you know what I mean? Like you were like watching this like a verklempt, you know, mother, like feeling so terrible for all the bad things that were going to happen to Carrie. And I agree with you. It's a funny feeling to have in something that's meant to be a horror film. And it makes me question whether this is really a traditional horror film, or maybe the reason that I like it has a lot to do with all the things that are not like a horror film.
Well, you know, since we're talking about gut reactions, there's a line in it in which the teacher, Mrs. Collins, who in the book is Miss Desjardins,
yes,
she says after the scene in the shower with the menstruation, she feels sympathy for Carrie, but she also said, you know, I can totally understand why this gang mentality, you know, went for her. This girl's had her period and she's freaking the fuck out and she's 16 years of age. It kind of makes you feel that she's already failed in life. She is pathetic.
What you just said relates to a line that Carrie says to her mother when they're having the debate about whether Carrie should go to the prom, and she says, "This is my chance to be a whole person before it's too late." This poor girl has basically been denied her complete humanity, both by her mother and by these other people in the school. And really, I guess she has two people that she begins to connect with. One is Tommy, the boy who asks her out on the date. They kind of seem to start to bond, and he does kiss her, seemingly very genuinely, and gives her that, like, Cinderella moment. But the relationship in the film that I was really struck by was her relationship with the teacher, Miss Collins, as she's called in this, played by stage veteran Betty Buckley. I mean, memories all alone in the moonlight. There
Brian,
she is.
If you see any more, we'll have to pay Andrew Weber money. I ain't giving no money to a Tory. Pardon my taxes.
I only want Andrew Lloyd Webber to buy me a swimming pool. And if you don't know what I'm talking about, talk to Patti LuPone. Anyway, back to Betty Buckley. The teacher character is way more interesting and complex, I would say, in the film than Miss Desjardins in the novel, because, like you said, she sort of seems to express a kind of, like, dumbfoundedness with Carrie's complete innocence. But she also really lashes out at the girls when she's punishing them. As we pointed out when we were watching it, and we later did a bit of research, like, Betty Buckley is clearly the exact same age as the actresses who are playing all the high school girls. Like, she is way too young to be the teacher, and they are way too old to be the students. But Miss Collins has this kind of weird maternal, I would even say bordering on
sapphic
thing with Carrie.
Use that word.
Yeah, yeah. She's like telling her how beautiful is she, and she's nurturing her, and she's being very affectionate with her. It does feel weird. You're like, why is this teacher so obsessed with this one particular girl?
And isn't that joke when Tommy goes off to get some fruit punch during the prom scene where, like, they embrace and he's like, hey, what do you do with my prom days?
Well, that's what I mean. Yeah, so there is that kind of weird question of why the teacher cares so much about Carrie, but then Carrie's own mother is so lacking in any form of affection or nurturing or tenderness that Miss Collins is kind of like the good mother figure, right, for Carrie, that Carrie's never had. Sissy Spacek plays it so infantile. Do you know what I mean? That kind of like soft-spoken, wide-eyed, babyish quality. She's just, her growth is so stunted.
A bit like Miranda in The Tempest.
Oh, brave new world that has such telekinesis in it. Yes. Okay, so those were our gut reactions. I mean, I think my gut reaction, number one, was to say, that doesn't look like Maine to me. As a true New Englander, I would say that this film has perpetrated a lie.
Yes, it is absolutely 100% not Maine.
It's Southern California.
Yeah, nowhere
else. There
are,
like, freaking palm trees. For me, something about Stephen King is so wrapped up in that kind of rural, small-town New England creepiness, which, you know, Dolores Claiborne plays up so nicely. But do you think that the Southern Cal golden surfer...
I think it makes no difference.
I think it actually ramps up that kind of, like, teen movie quality of it.
Because everyone's expected to be more beautiful, is that it?
Yeah, people seem beautiful. They're wearing their little 70s athletic shorts, which you admired
loved,
so much.
I would love to be wearing those shorts right
and it,
now.
But it's like everyone in this movie seems to be in, like, a Aussie shampoo ad with their, like, elegantly coiffed. I mean, Amy Irving and whoever the kid who played Tommy, like, their hair is so freaking curled. Like, if they ever had children, like, those curls would be, like, you'd need, like, a quadratic equation to define how much curl was in that hair. They both looked like they were spending so much time at the salon getting that perm, you know? Everyone has that, like, corn-fed California kind of look to them, which is part of what makes Piper Laurie's mama character seem so out of place, because everything is so sun-dappled and golden and bright. The house that Sue Snell lives in is so much like a California kind of style house. And then the house that the whites live in, the
haunted house.
Fucking like witch's den. That's like completely dark. There's no sunlight.
There's no neighbors either.
the California setting, I think they use it to good effect.
Yeah.
Were there other, like, highlights of the movie that struck you this time?
Well, you know, I was just thinking, dramaturgically, how many films are there in which they're building up to this one hugely dramatic moment in which the whole first 50 minutes is a build up to something?
I think that's what is striking about both the book and this, is really very little happens. The incident with the menstruation leads very causally, point to point to point to point, to this terrible prom. It is a very simple thread of a story. I was looking at one of the reviews from the 70s earlier, and they were saying, like, there is so little incident in this that they have to stretch a lot of things out with slow-mo just to, like, make it feel like a feature film.
Well, I quite like that. The meat on the bones of this film are so lean.
Right, no, exactly. What I'm saying is, it's a movie that lives and dies by its atmosphere, sort of more than its event. And you get that right from the start. I mean, that opening scene in the shower and the locker room,
I've got such a better appreciation for it this time. I kind of used to wonder, why was it so self-focused? Why would that, like, kind of melancholically beautiful piano music, all the girls, like, in slow-mo with their teenage tits, teenage, just, like, hopping up and down, and then we kind of wander into this gauze of steam to see, like, she feels,
Basic looks
she
like
feels
a
very
silk,
French, you know. French New Wave.
Yeah.
You're really.
Yeah.
Which we know that De Palma was.
Or even more than French New Wave, it's like French exploitation film. I mean, there is definitely a weird male gaze going on in that of Brian De Palma filming this, like, female space and these female breasts and Sissy Spacek soaping herself, yeah, and the intensity of the skin. You definitely get this sense of, like, the boy sneaking into the girl's locker, yeah, room. I mean, De Palma, right, loved Hitchcock and is all in that sense of, like, the Hitchcock gaze, the complicity, the audience's complicity. If part of Carrie is about how desire and hormones get out of control and the kind of change that comes with adolescence, then I suppose the film director tapping into his own horny teenage boy self is part of that, because it kind of puts the audience in this hormonal gaze of a teenager.
But how quickly that's cut through like a knife, because you're there seeing her soaping herself up and then we see blood in her hand.
It's also the screaming, yeah, girls and their feral quality.
But the way Carrie walks into the pile of girls, you know,
right,
and like, she's walking like a zombie, you know, arms outstretched. She's showing them the blood.
Or a naked animal.
Yeah. As far as she's concerned, she is bleeding. She's hemorrhaging.
Yeah.
And she's waving this blood in front of them. And it's kind of like this really disturbing juxtaposition of the girls being grossed out by this girl waving her period at them,
yeah,
versus the girl who feels that she's been hurt, attacked.
Well, and then she is attacked because they become a pack of angry dogs or wolves, like, lashing out at her. I think the thing about this movie, it's a weirdly small film, I guess I would say, in the sense that it's not very long. It doesn't have a lot of incident. And the tropes of the film are very few in number. There's blood, there's laughing and mockery, do you know what I mean? There's certain kind of religious stigmata type images that recur. And so De Palma deploys these things really effectively so that in that opening locker room scene, you're introduced to all these ideas of vulnerability and mockery and blood and destruction and attack that will literally be almost point for point repeated when we return to the prom. The blood all over her and her screaming for help, like, everything is kind of very neatly balanced and bookended. It's a beautifully directed film.
It is. It's filmed in that 70s style, which feels unobtrusively natural, but also stylized to excess when it needs to be. You know, like, when we're watching those scenes of the girls in the detention, it just feels so kind of ordinary. And you contrast that with, you know, the scene later on in which Carrie and Tommy are waltzing at the prom, and there's a whole stylistic element of play there. Nothing feels obtrusive about this, you know?
It's done with a great sensuality.
Yeah.
I noticed the DP and the
Composer
are Italian.
Yeah.
And so there's this sense of, like, that kind of Visconti sort of sensuality,
yeah,
that's kind of permeating the way it's filmed. And just to cut back briefly to that scene of the detention, what did you say about the detention?
Oh, I would have loved that detention.
Why?
Because you just get a workout.
It's like a boot camp fitness
class.
Yeah,
there's absolutely no team sports involved, which just makes me perfectly content.
Yeah, although you did say that their push-ups were not particularly good.
Well, girl push-ups are easier than boy push-ups.
Oh, yeah? What if you're weighted down by quite a bit more, you know, flesh right
it's
there?
It's the 70s. Everyone had small breasts.
Or no one had a big breast in the 70s.
Yeah, it wasn't in, so they didn't grow that big.
What, duh. Do you want to talk to Bette Midler?
Yes, I'd love to. Do you have her number? I'd love
to. Get her on the phone. Hello? Is this a Hello Dolly rehearsal room? Anyway, the one thing I would say is, from having seen the movie before and now having read the book, there are some striking differences, I think, from the book. I actually think the book is way more horrific. Yes, there's a huge fire and immolation in the high school, but in the book, page after page after page, like, Carrie destroys the entire town.
Yeah, she kills indiscriminately as well.
Yeah, well, she kills indiscriminately. We don't see charred bodies in the film. In fact, the only person, interestingly enough, who really very clearly gets impaled and killed is the teacher, who does not die in the book. So they switch some things around to, like, soften certain things.
They harden it elsewhere.
But harden other things.
Yeah, because killing the teacher who was on her side, it means a lot. Executing the principal who we all hate is like, yeah.
Well, he survives in the book as well.
What?
Yeah, they both
do.
Remember,
I forgot that. In the movie when Mrs. Collins dies, like, no.
Well, yeah. I mean, she gets like a giant...
Like my astute observations there.
She gets a giant, like, beam that, like, impales her in her stomach. And also, the other, like, major plot difference is how Carrie herself dies. So in the film, she's already gotten her revenge on Chris and
Billy
by flipping over their car and killing them. And then she goes home to confront her mother. She washes off all the blood, again, in a kind of bookending cleansing. She's begun with showering in the first scene of the film, and now she's washing off all the blood.
You know, I was watching thinking that. I'd love to have a bath soon.
Ladies and gentlemen, we do have a bathtub, we just have poor plumbing here at Broad Appeal HQ. So she and her mother confront each other. The mother tries to kill Carrie. Carrie kills the mother with knives in her. And then in the movie, the house, for some reason that I don't understand, starts to collapse in on itself and sink into the ground.
You don't like this.
And it's not that I don't like it. I just don't understand it. Because in the book, the mother confesses to Carrie how she was conceived and how part of her hatred for Carrie and her self-loathing has all been about her own complicated feelings as a woman about the sexuality that resulted in her giving birth. And Carrie leaves her mother for dead and leaves the house, and then she finally confronts Sue Snell when she's, like, practically bled to death from the wound that her mother has inflicted, and she's going to the roadhouse where...
Now, what is a roadhouse?
A roadhouse is some sort of by-the-road dive bar, you know, where truckers and prostitutes may get together. Ooh, to...
My kind of venue.
It is, it is. She's going out to the roadhouse, which is where she was conceived. So it's this, like, Freudian thing of, like, re-confronting the sin that her mother has talked to her about. Something about that feels more powerful and tragic, because I just don't understand why suddenly the house sinks into the ground.
It's like pathetic fallacy, isn't it?
Say more.
Well, I'm perfectly content with that ending. I love it.
Who is causing the house to sink into the ground?
It's Carrie's overwhelming emotion and her telekinesis. Remember, Carrie has only been moving ashtrays before this, and then she destroys the entire school.
Well, but
it's like being in a rage, okay, Carrie too, in which the things she has been through, her mother stabs her, she then impales her mother crucifixion style. And
but then what did she... So are you saying it's a suicide?
No, I'm saying I'm saying that Carrie was dying anyway, and this, like, uncontrollable power, which she has no control over truly, just causes the foundations of her home just to crumble. I think it's perfect.
Okay.
I think your ending is just far too...
It's not my ending, it's Stephen King's ending.
I just think your ending is far too...
My ending!
Like, oh, let's go here, let's open it up, let's make it more less like a stage play.
No, that is not what I'm talking about. I'm talking about the, like, confrontation of a young woman seeking her origins that her mother have told her are sin, and then having a realization and then dying as a vulnerable mortal, not like sinking into the ground like some kind of devil spawn. It feels weird to me in the movie. I will also say, though, what's interesting is that in the book, She's already rained stones down on the house as a very young girl.
Yeah, that happens in the TV movie version.
Well, it also apparently was filmed for this De Palma movie, but it looked so poor because they didn't have the right kind of special effects, and he was like, let's just cut it out.
And how old would Carrie have been?
It was literally going to be like the first scene of the film, like as a kind of prologue of the stones raining down on the house.
I'm glad it's cut.
Yeah, no, I think it works because the reading that you just gave, that her telekinesis has never reached this extent, that it's kind of, this is the biggest extent that it's ever been, makes a lot more sense in the film, whereas in the book, the mother really thinks she's a dangerous witch because she's already rained stones down from the sky.
Yeah, and don't you think that starting as a teen movie, you know, where the loser's getting humiliated, then turning into the horror tragedy we know to be, is far more interesting than being like, ooh, scary things have happened at the start, can't wait till they keep happening again.
I'm not saying that one is better than the other, but I just want to point out, Sean, that the person you're criticizing here is not me, as you often are. It's Stephen fucking King, okay? So what you're basically now saying is that Stephen King was poorly conceived his own original material.
No, I'm thinking in terms of literary creation, I think it's absolutely fine. But in cinema, mm-hmm. I think this works much
No, I
better.
Agree. Yeah. I agree. It works really, yeah. really well. Can we talk about now the performances?
Absolutely. Do you feel that these performances justified Academy Award nominations?
Yes. I suppose I do.
You're hesitating.
I am hesitating. Let's be honest about this. This is not the kind of movie that I really care all that much about. Like, I think this movie succeeds on everything that it's doing, and I think Sissy Spacek in particular is really, really integral to its success because she is both a wounded animal and a shy...
A demonic creature.
Right, but she's also a shy budding flower. Yeah. She's sweet, she's pretty. Like, she goes through all these different
beats
of it, this evolution. She's also really soft-spoken through the whole film. Like, she seems quite fragile. And that's what makes her transformation in the last section where her eyes are, like, literally bulging out of her face and her mouth is kind of
Have you also noticed that she holds her hands as well? She holds her hands to her sides with the palms pointed outwards. But it comes back to that implacability that I mentioned in the first half. Because she is kind of freaky looking, you know? But she also has this warmth to her, this kind of, like, southern aunt kind of way, but also, like, crazy woodland woman.
And she also feels both old and young. I mean, she was, I think, like, way
26.
Older. Yeah, she's way older than an actual high schooler would have been, but since everyone else was the wrong age, that was fine.
But she looks about 16.
Exactly. It's not unlike that quality we were identifying about Tilda from our last episode, Orlando, that, like, in a way, she's both old and young at the same time. Mm. This is a great performance. I think my hesitation in saying, is it an Academy Award nomination-worthy performance? Is just that, like, can you think of another performance like that that's ever been nominated for an Academy Award? It's, like, so... Mm. Do you know what I mean?
I was going to say Kathy Bates in Misery, but that's not the
No, no.
Not parallel,
Kathy Bates in Misery is, like, way more histrionic and, like, big speeches and, like, character tics. The character of Carrie, as played by Sissy Spacek, seems to just sort of be fully formed as part of this strange atmosphere. It's actually a very natural and nuanced role that is also weird and demonic. She's almost like a special effect in the film herself. I mean, and for that reason, it's, like, absolutely extraordinary. I don't know that anyone could study what she's doing and say, oh, I'm going to do this for another part. It's, like, kind of so distinctive to this particular film.
I wonder who else was in mind for that role.
I have no idea. I don't know who could have done it.
Which is why the idea of Chloe Grace Moretz playing it in 2015 or whatever year it was, it's just kind of preposterous. I mean, next remake will be Jennifer Lawrence as Carrie's mother and an unborn Fanning as Carrie White.
Well, the three of the most dread-inducing words in the world are Chloe Grace Moretz, if you ask me. The only thing she's ever been good in, as far as I'm concerned, is The Clouds of Sils Maria, where she's meant to be the butt of a joke.
Yeah.
Right? She's meant to literally be the actress that gets cast in something and you're like, oh God, not her.
Yeah, I really liked her in that.
Yeah, I know.
I love Clouds of Sils Maria. Can we watch it immediately after this podcast is finished recording?
I think we could. So that's Sissy Spacek. Now, I have to say, I have similar feelings about Piper Laurie. Like, she is just so off the wall.
Okay, if I can interject, I think that this was one of those cases that she got kind of a coattail nomination. Not to say she isn't deserving of acclaim. I just kind of find it hard to be like, okay, of all the performances of the year, and this is the 70s we're talking about, which is a good decade for women.
I think this is one of those examples of the reason that she's nominated is she is chewing the most scenery of anyone.
The boys! The boys! Yes, the boys! After the blood come the boys, like sniffing dogs, running and slobbering and trying to find out where that smell comes from, where the smell is. That smell.
She doesn't seem to be in the same movie as everybody else. And I think that is what would give it that sort of like Renee Zellweger in Cold Mountain kind of edge.
Ooh,
where like
a very interesting point.
No,
there.
But you know what I mean? Like you walk away from it being like, oh my god, and the mother.
Like let's reward her something for that weird performance.
And how can you play that character in any other way? I mean, Stephen King has written her to just be like not just a conservative, harsh, strict mother, but literally a nut job. The lines that she has to say, I don't think you can say those lines in any other way than with 1,000% commitment. Like, sometimes it feels comic, but it definitely gets really fucking scary. I actually think that Piper Laurie's performance is probably the scariest element of the movie. Like, scarier even than the prom and the fire. Like, at the end, when she has got it into her head that you cannot suffer a witch to live, and she has to kill her own daughter, her fucking expression when she's coming down the stairs with
smiling,
that knife,
yeah.
Smiling in this weird beatific way. I mean, she's the demon possessed one.
Well,
not
I would say
poor Carrie.
The scariest scene is actually when Carrie is putting on her makeup in the mirror and Piper Laurie starts pulling at her hair and like,
yeah,
you know,
and she says,
"Mama,
don't hurt yourself."
Yeah, that is indicative of a kind of emotional blackmail that's been happening all this young girl's life. Where she is made to feel worse for her situation because she sees her mother flagellating in front of her.
The more we talk about it, are you actually appreciating what Piper Laurie is
doing? No, I completely appreciate it.
Like,
I really
because
do.
I think actually she hits these notes that are about her sexual disgust, but also her jealousy, because that's that weird twisted psychology that comes out because before she kills Carrie, she confesses how Carrie was conceived, and she, the mother, both hated and liked it.
I liked it. I liked it.
And that's why the whole going back to the roadhouse thing makes sense, but perhaps some people would just rather see a crumbling colonial house fall into a pit of rocks. Anyway, what about the other people? Can we run through them? I mean, we've already talked a bit about Betty Buckley as Miss Collins. Mm-hmm. I think she's great.
I thought that Nancy Allen... Is that right?
Yeah, you got it right this time, Nancy Allen.
I think that Nancy Allen was gorgeous as Chrissy Hargison in that kind of really soft bouffant perm, blonde, glossed lips, open mouth,
well, yeah, the
wetness.
I mean, Brian De Palma really emphasizes that, right? There's lots of shots of her lips and her tongue and everything, and he eventually married her.
Yeah, but I also like the fact that she's wicked as well, because usually it's like the soft focus girl, it's like the but really she's an asshole.
And another thing that ramps up her villainy, in the book the boys go by themselves to the pig farm to get the pig. In the film she's there with them, and then she's egging Billy on to like kill the pig, and so she's there like thirsty for blood. I have to say the one very unrealistic detail is in the scene in the car where she's giving John Travolta a blowjob. Like her head goes down below the screen and she's saying, "Oh Billy, oh Billy," and we were both
like how could she talk with a dick in her mouth?
Yeah, I know, like there's not even any like Foley work there.
There's no kind of like it'd be like 2 seconds of sucking dick, "Oh Billy, 1, 2, oh Billy." It's like, "Oh Billy, oh Billy, oh Billy, oh
Billy, 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 I hate Carrie White."
Who?
I mean, maybe we just assumed it was a blowjob. Maybe it's a jerk-off.
What's she doing? Licking his balls?
Maybe she's giving him a handjob.
I don't think so.
This is when we need better sound mixing. Where's, what's his name? 32-time nominee Kevin O'Donnell.
Very good. 22.
22, whatever it is. He should have been in there. He could have helped with that blowjob. Okay, that's Nancy Allen. And we have to give some sort of analysis of podcast favorite Amy Irving. She has a very subdued feline quality.
Yeah.
I mean, having watched Yentl recently and this, she always seems like slightly sleepy and sort of withdrawn and a little bit sly. Do you know what I mean?
I like that.
She's almost like a second-rate Michelle Pfeiffer. And Michelle Pfeiffer obviously is feline, you know, Catwoman, but that kind of like purring sort of quality, which is a weird but interesting way to play Sue Snell, because my version of Sue Snell is like, she's the good girl who did a bad thing and now feels really bad and is like making penance. She's like the good Catholic school girl who's gonna like...
But she's Jewish.
I know, but I'm saying that the character in the book feels like, oh, she's like ultimately the good virginal girl who did a bad thing is now gonna make up for it. Whereas Amy Irving's version of Sue Snell, she wants to help Carrie, but like, how authentically does she actually want to help Carrie? You know?
She does.
But the way Amy Irving plays it, you know?
But what I find difficult is how the boyfriend, who goes from saying, you suck in class, like, I felt his hatred for Carrie. He really has a full 180.
Yeah, because that scene in the prom where he finally, where he snogs her. I mean, yeah. He kisses her. I mean, that's very romantic. It's during that kind of really swoony shot where the camera is spinning around and around.
They're going in a different direction.
It's true.
Yeah, that's actually one part that I find difficult too.
What do you mean?
He clearly hates Carrie. He's clearly an asshole bro. And I'm just kind of like, So where's his change of heart?
So that sort of progression didn't make as much sense to you?
No, it didn't.
I think actually De Palma is really playing up the kind of cynical inhumanity of all of the people in this school, with the exception of Miss Collins. And that is there in the book, but Sue definitely feels like a good person, and Tommy feels like a good person in the book. And here, he's really saying, how good are they? Mm. Well, I'm really glad to have rewatched Carrie again. I'm interested to have read it. It doesn't make me want to go and read more Stephen King or to watch all that much more horror. I think horror, for me, will always be a genre that I'm, like, gonna read a few reviews, and if I read enough reviews from critics that I generally like that say, this is a horror movie for people who don't like horror movies, then I'll go.
Well, I would like you to go and see It with me when it comes out this
year.
No
way. No freaking way.
Oh, why not?
Because I won't go see that. I just won't. I have
why don't you like to be scared? I love being scared.
Because life is scary enough, Sean.
And on that note...
No, seriously. I will go see the best of the genre. But what is it that the horror film does for you?
Well, the horror film is an extension of the spectacles of cinema. It shows you things that are unimaginable. And unimaginability is both, you know, something incredibly beautiful, but also something quite terrifying. Which is why I have a bit of an admiration for the Hellraiser films. Because
the number of times that Sean has proposed to do Hellraiser on this podcast, ladies and gentlemen, if I had a penny for every time.
I mean, the great Claire Higgins. She's a wonderful stage actress, Brian.
Carry on.
The basis of Hellraiser is that there's this sadomasochistic hell that exists where pleasure seekers go to find the ultimate form of pleasure. And the pleasure that they find is this demonic, hellish torture, which is, you know, the sublime. The horror film encapsulates the sublime quite well. It is wonderment, it is terror, it is the uncanny, it is fear, it is spectacle.
I totally get that when you're talking about something like Carrie, which is really well made, but you're not going to tell me that most horror films live up to that standard.
I'm not saying
of the
that.
Things that come out. So what are the horror films that you're telling me that are out now that I need to see?
Out now?
Yeah.
Well, there are none, babe.
Well, that's what I'm saying. When you have a genre where a lot of the stuff is like mass-produced schlock, and then I'm saying I will go once a year to the critically acclaimed ones that are good.
Raw. That's kind of a horror film.
Yeah, that actually looks really good. And isn't that European? It's like Romanian or something.
It's French. It says Romanian surname.
Okay. Well, there you go. I might be induced to go see that. Plus, the guy looks really hot in it.
Okay.
The guy in the trailer.
I'm thinking more of the horror myself. We are not living in the age of the prestige horror movie at the moment, which is really sad. Like, I would like the prestige horror film to come back. I know I mentioned...
But it has come back. There was a prestige horror movie that was the number one film at the box office just a couple of weeks ago.
Yeah, but babe, that's an anomaly. It is not a return to the genre. I'm talking about, like, hey, The Babadook was a horror film.
I liked that.
Yeah, I liked it too.
But what I liked about it was, like Carrie, it was a character study about something that I could connect with, which is, like, single mother... loss of the father, fear of the child. Like, what you just described about Hellraiser has absolutely no relationship to anything I give a shit about. I'm
okay,
sorry.
Fair enough.
Do you know what I mean?
Like, fair enough. I just think you're really limiting yourself. I watched some period dramas with you, you know.
Yeah, but you actually like every single one that you watch.
Yeah, but I was reticent before I watched them. And now I like some of them.
Literally, Sean, what is the film that you're telling me you need to watch? Because I liked The Fly. I liked this. I liked It Follows. I liked The Babadook. You know what I mean?
I want you to watch Hellraiser with me. A while ago, didn't I say, if you watch the trailer for Hellraiser 2, I won't ask you to watch Hellraiser for another year?
And that was I did watch
the
trailer.
Yeah, that was like a month ago.
And so, I didn't like the trailer.
Yeah, but you get 11 months now.
Yeah, but now what you're doing is you're hijacking our podcast to re-litigate this debate.
I will re-litigate this debate in 11 months' time.
Ladies and gentlemen, this is going out to our many dozens of listeners. So you heard it here. If Sean says the word Hellraiser again, I'm out. I'm out.
Oh, please. Let me say it one more time. Oh, Candyman. Let's watch Candyman.
Okay.
Also, Wishmaster is quite good. You know, what happens when you make an evil wish, you know?
Do you know the number of times that I've tried to get you to watch Bringing Up Baby all the way through to the end?
I'd like us to watch Wishmaster.
Notice what Sean does, ladies and gentlemen. I like to call him Teflon Sean. You just throw something and it bounces right off. It doesn't stick. This is why his political career is coming very, very soon. Sean, do you have anything else to say about Carrie?
I'm really glad we watched it.
So am I, and I'm glad that I read the book. I can now say that I've done something that billions of people have done around the world. I've read a Stephen King novel. What's next? Shall I cook some rice?
And beans.
Speaking of what's next, and speaking of acclaimed books and movies that have also been made into Broadway musicals, our next episode is going to be not red, but purple.
But it's going to be read by both of us.
What film are we going to be watching?
Watching The Color Purple. I am halfway through the book. I'll be finished by the end of the week. I'm really enjoying this book. I'm really looking forward to this film.
Obviously, the acclaimed Pulitzer Prize winning novel by Alice Walker. It's something that I'm really ashamed to say I've never read, so very excited to finish the book. The movie has a mixed reputation because obviously it ushered in the film careers of people like Whoopi Goldberg and Oprah Winfrey, but it was also directed by Steven Spielberg. Mm. And there's also, I think, a lot of questions about like racial and feminine authenticity around that.
Let's talk about that in 2 weeks.
Well, we'll be seeing Purple in a couple of weeks, and we hope we'll be seeing you too.
In the meantime, if people want to get in touch with us, they can follow us at Broad Appeal Pod. They can also follow us individually. I'm at Sean McGovern X and you're at VA Mullen Speaks. We also have a Gmail address should you feel like writing to us, broadappealpod@gmail.com.
Now let's get out those dirty pillows and go to sleep.
Pillow fight.
See you soon.
Bye.
I'm not sure, but the more that it's real, the more it's right.